England and Wales, it will be a fine long weekend, and where the sun comes out, it'll feel quite warm. For Scotland and Northern Ireland, cool and breezy, some brighter spells, but some rain at times through the long weekend, particularly in the far northwest. That's the forecast.
Thanks, Alex. And now on Radio 4, our Book of the Week. In 1997, Margaret Thatcher invited Charles Moore to write her biography on the understanding that it would not be published until after her death. In today's extract, Mrs. Thatcher enters Downing Street as Britain's first woman Prime Minister, following the Tory victory in the 1979 general election. Nicholas Farrell reads from Margaret Thatcher, the authorised biography.
Margaret Thatcher arrived at Buckingham Palace shortly before 3 p.m. on the 4th of May 1979, accompanied by Dennis. The first woman Prime Minister wore a blue outfit with a pleated skirt, which Cynthia Crawford, her assistant who had helped her choose it, described as very dainty. Mrs. Thatcher saw the Queen and thus received the authority to take up office. Jim Callaghan's principal private secretary, Ken Stowe, who automatically continued to do the same job for the new Prime Minister, advised her to sit in the official car immediately behind the driver, rather than on the other side of the back seats. This was to ensure that she could get out of the car at the door of 10 Downing Street without the waiting press and photographers seeing her legs first. As she pushed through the door of Downing Street, she was greeted by the assembled staff, roughly 70 strong. The introductions completed, Ken Stowe led Mrs. Thatcher to the cabinet room, where all the briefs awaited. At the door, she turned to Stowe and asked him,
"Ken, what do I do now?"
"You might want to speak to the cabinet secretary, Prime Minister," said Stowe. "You've got to form an administration." This little exchange was heartening for Stowe and his colleagues in the private office. The officials were relieved to find her turning to them for help. Mrs. Thatcher had a temperamental and ideological suspicion of the civil service. Her time at education had made her angry about how officialdom could frustrate what she believed needed doing. Many expected that she would make radical changes in the machinery of government. At lunchtime on the day of the handover of power, Jim Callaghan had collected all his closest Downing Street assistants for a modest and melancholy farewell meal of cottage pie. The civil servants present had fully expected to be the victims of the fierce new broom which would begin sweeping that afternoon. That night, however, they found themselves sitting at a scratch supper in the state dining room with the new Prime Minister, huddled at the end of the table by the fireplace, eating cottage pie for the second time in a day. Mrs. Thatcher had no plans to get rid of anyone. In fact, in this area, she had almost no plans at all. She did not believe that the bureaucracy should be reshaped from top to bottom, but rather that it should be regalvanized. Mrs. Thatcher's chief method of exerting her will over the machine was not institutional, but personal. She used every remark, every memo, every meeting as an opportunity to challenge existing habits, criticize any sign of ignorance, confusion, or waste, and preach incessantly the main aims of her administration. In forming her first cabinet, as in her dealings with the civil service, Mrs. Thatcher displayed a similar, slightly surprising tendency not to want to upset the institutional applecart. Her appointments sought political balance more than ideological affinity. She turned first to Willie Whitelaw, whom she immediately made Home Secretary and, in effect, Deputy Prime Minister. Her friend Hector Lang once praised Whitelaw to her for his low cunning and lovable dimness. Mrs. Thatcher laughed and said, "I'm not very good at either." When he accepted his post of Deputy Leader in 1975, Whitelaw had told her, "I shall give you my 100% loyalty on one condition, that you never make Keith Joseph Chancellor." She kept her promise and chose Geoffrey Howe. Her relations with Howe were not very easy, and she tended to say,
The trouble with people like Geoffrey, lawyers, is that they are too timid.
Conveniently forgetting that she was a lawyer herself. In the end, there were no women in Mrs. Thatcher's first cabinet apart from herself. Of the six most senior men in the cabinet, all were older than she, and only two, Howe and Joseph, agreed with her economic strategy. For most of the older men who had fought in the Second World War, and in the case of Whitelaw, Carrington and Pym, won the Military Cross, there was a difficulty in taking their new Prime Minister seriously. They did not conspire against her, but neither did they think it very likely that she would survive. She was conscious of being patronised and of being in a minority. On Sunday the 6th of May, her chief whip, Michael Jopling, joined her and Willie Whitelaw for lunch in No. 10 to discuss the list of proposed appointments to junior ministerial posts. It was, he discovered, her first sight of the flat, which she and Dennis were to inhabit for more than 11 years. The flat, at the top of the house, was small and almost pokey. Cynthia Crawford, who helped sort it out, found its laundry room full of dead plants. Its kitchen was no more than a galley. It suited Mrs. Thatcher, however. She liked the idea of living over the shop, as in her Grantham childhood, and the convenience of being so close to the work she loved. Security was greater, and she hoped that her children, now in their 20s, could come and see her easily. Dennis, retired since 1975, was happy to throw himself into the life of No. 10. "Margaret thought I helped at receptions," he remembered. "I thought I might as well enjoy it." The couple continued to live in Flood Street, Chelsea, until early June, while the flat was being refurbished, and then moved in. Dennis paid rent to the government for the flat. Mrs. Thatcher paid for its redecoration, and also for the redecoration of her first-floor study in No. 10, which looks over St. James's Park, banishing the sage-green wallpaper, which she disliked. Due to the remarkable strictness of government rules on such matters, the Thatchers were provided with no help of any kind in looking after their flat. They paid cleaning women themselves, and it fell to them, in practice to Mrs. Thatcher herself, since Dennis had old-fashioned views on these matters, to procure their own food and cook it. Dennis was known to hurry home from drinks with chums after ringing No. 10. "She says if I don't come now, dinner will be cold." Quite often, owing to the demands of office, he came home to nothing. But he did not mind unduly being a man who preferred drinking to eating. He used to fear what he called cosmic obloquy from her, when he didn't eat whatever food was put before him. In 1979, there were no computers at all in Downing Street, and Mrs. Thatcher drew heavily on the services of the career secretaries and typists, traditionally known as the garden room girls, because they worked in the two basement rooms which look onto the garden of No. 10. They took dictation, summoned by buzzers, and they generally made everything work. Mrs. Thatcher would bounce into the garden room to see what was going on. She liked to watch her office in action. One private secretary was at his desk one day, having a long argument with the Treasury on the telephone. He felt he had lost the battle, and as he put down the receiver, swore violently. Then he noticed that the Prime Minister had come in and was sitting at the desk beside him. Her eyes were shining with pleasure.
"Temper, temper," she said.
The first woman Prime Minister had needs previously unknown in Downing Street. Frequent hairdressing was required, but the private office was uneasy about putting the word hairdresser into the diary, on the grounds that it detracted from the dignity of the office. After discussion, the phrase Carmen Rollers was agreed as a sort of code. Mrs. Thatcher's clothes were looked after in the early days, chiefly by Lady Guinevere Tilney. She was known, slightly mockingly, as the Mistress of the Robes. Cynthia Crawford, Crawfy, later succeeded to the informal title. One day early in Mrs. Thatcher's first administration, she discovered that one of the ministerial flats in Admiralty House, vacant at the time, had several good bits of government furniture. She procured the key and personally led a party of the No. 10 steward, her appointments secretary, and her detective to the flat. She walked round, pointing at pictures, chairs, and so on, saying, "I'll have that and that." The party of burglars carrying their loot then returned to number 10, with the Prime Minister at their head. Probably the most important member of Mrs. Thatcher's personal entourage was her parliamentary private secretary, Ian Gough, the MP for Eastbourne. Gough was a keenly intelligent and intensely diligent man. He was completely, chivalrously committed to Mrs. Thatcher, whom he was the first to describe as the lady. "I shall love her," he declared to the less enamoured Geoffrey Howe, "till the day I die." In truth, a significant factor in Mrs. Thatcher's political success was that quite large numbers of men fell for her. Sir Hector Lang, the chairman of United Biscuits, would send her notes which he requested be placed under her pillow. Kingsley Amis, the novelist, described her as "one of the best-looking women I had ever met." The fact that it is not a sensual or sexy beauty does not make it a less sexual beauty, and that sexuality is still, I think, an underrated factor in her appeal, or repellence. Brian Walden reported David Owen as saying to him, "The whiff of that perfume, the sweet smell of whiskey. By God, Brian, she's appealing beyond belief." Alan Clarke, when asked about the nature of his love for Mrs. Thatcher, said, "I don't want actual penetration, just a massive snog." Gough's commitment to Mrs. Thatcher was ideological as well as personal. He was the closest upholder of her sense of purpose. She drew from him the spirit of what she was trying to achieve. The global impact of Margaret Thatcher was immediate and enormous, because she was, after Golda Meir of Israel, the first elected woman leader in the Western world. Yet, despite the criticism she had already attracted for being image-conscious in opposition, Mrs. Thatcher gave extraordinarily little thought to media relations. She was so irritated by questions about being a woman that the press office had to warn foreign journalists off the subject. She did not really read the newspapers herself, beyond a cursory glance at Dennis's Daily Telegraph, and it was hard to persuade her to pay much attention to what they were saying. Although her supporters were adept at using sympathetic journalists to push their line, there was nothing like the modern systematic management of coverage. The idea of planning an announcement round the hoped-for headline was unknown, and the word spin had no currency in British politics. In November, Mrs. Thatcher appointed Bernard Ingham as her press secretary. He developed a daily press digest for her. This briefing became her window on the world. "The real problem," Ingham remembered, "was that she was not in touch. She knew nothing about pop music or popular television programs. She might, in her early days, read the first two columns of the Financial Times, but they did not exactly keep her in touch with what Britain was thinking. It was a strength of hers that she did not bother her head with the petty intrigues and black arts of newspapers. But Ingham thought, she was unprofessional in not thinking about presentation enough." What Ingham noticed at once, however, was Mrs. Thatcher's gifts as a public performer. She was very concerned about her physical appearance when going on television. As Ingham put it, "she was an actress who could turn on a tremendous performance when it had to be turned on." She was not media-minded, but she was a media star.
Nicholas Farrell reads the final extract from Margaret Thatcher, the authorised biography by Charles Moore, at the same time tomorrow. The abridger was Richard Hamilton and the producer was Elizabeth Allard. This is BBC Radio 4. And now the shipping forecast issued by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency at 0015 on Friday the 3rd of May. There are warnings of gales in Viking, North Utsira, South Utsira, Shannon, Rockall, Malin, Bailey and South East Iceland. The general synopsis at 1800. Low Hebrides, 1011, expected Norway, 1006 by 1800 tomorrow. New low expected 4th, 1006 by same time. The area forecast for the next 24 hours. Viking North Utsira, cyclonic 6 to gale 8, becoming southeasterly 5 later, rain moderate or poor. South Utsira, southeast 40s, southerly 6 or 7, occasionally gale 8 in South Utsira, decreasing 5 later, rain moderate or poor. Northwest 40s, Cromarty, northwest 4th, southerly 5 to 7, becoming cyclonic 5.